This is one of the series of papers I've been writing over the last 5 or so years, all trying to make sense of a number of interrelated phenomena or processes which are to do with meditation, mindfulness, and the growing dialogue between Western and Asian approaches to mind consciousness and mind-body practices. I should perhaps explain the reason we ended up with this title. It was originally called Beyond Mindfulness. As some of you may know, a good friend of mine, Piers Salguero, gave a paper 3 weeks ago in Ottawa called Beyond Mindfulness, and so we decided maybe we should change my title. There you are. They're completely different papers, no overlap. I'm sure those of you who went to Pierce's paper will have enjoyed it greatly, but you won't hear the same from me tonight. Mindfulness movement is probably the most immediately salient to these phenomena. Now, I do need some way to move the screen on from one thing to another. And by this I refer to the widespread adoption of techniques and practices deriving from a particular set of Buddhist meditation techniques. Initially this happened within North American psychiatry and then more generally within Western societies. More about this later, though probably most of you have at least some knowledge of it because mindfulness is just about everywhere these days. And mindfulness for academic success, mindful eating, and mindful apartments. I don't know that they're really terribly mindful when it comes to it, but it seems to me that they have mindful materials, they're sustainable. as many of you will know, mindfulness has now become a kind of universal bit of positive text to add to more or less anything. Another significant process which feeds into my picture is the dialogue between Western science and Buddhist thought, particularly Tibetan Buddhist thought, which has got underway in recent years within contexts such as the Mind and Life Institute under the patronage and, in fact, with the active participation of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who you can see there. Linking these two areas is a growing body of research on Buddhist meditation within neuroscience and other related disciplines. Those are three of the, by now, quite substantial series of books. I think there have been at least 12, maybe 15, that the Mind and Life Institute has produced over the years. There have been more dialogues than that, but quite a number of them have resulted in books. I think Gentle Bridges was the first one. I think Destructive Emotions figures a little bit later on in the story. And here we can sort of images of the neuroscientific study of meditation that are becoming rather familiar. This is actually Mingyur Rinpoche linked up to EEG at the top, and I think some other Tibetan Lama being inserted into an fMRI scanner somewhere down the bottom, and you see a lot of this kind of stuff. So all of these activities are inspired in various ways by Buddhism, though often in quite secularized forms, and it seems to be mainly these Buddhist-derived activities that have inspired the various contemplative science and contemplative studies programs that are growing up around Canada and the USA in particular. As some of you will know, there's one of them based at the University of Ottawa, and actually I spoke to them yesterday, and some of you were there. More generally, though, these practices are part of you can kind of create a certain sort of field within which these activities fit together, but I think more generally this is really part of a wider context in which Hindu, Taoist, Sufi, Kabbalistic, and other traditions of self-development and life cultivation are also involved, as well as the various westernized derivatives of these traditions, including much of the so-called New Age. And all of these practices and modes of understanding originally located within specific, mostly Asian contexts, are becoming globalized, becoming available as part of the general heritage of humanity. And I think rather than focusing too narrowly on mindfulness or even on Buddhism, it's good to be aware of this wider context within which all this is happening. It's a rather obvious point, but this isn't always reflected, say, in the research agendas, which tend to have been quite closely focused on Buddhism. I'll say a little bit more about that later. But partly because all of this stuff is becoming part of how humanity generally seems to be, or the resources that humanity generally seems to be seeing as relevant in various ways, these things are also having to come to terms with the often quite different practices of modern science. So while a lot of the discussion about mindfulness and meditation tends to take a close focus on a small range of specific techniques and practices, the so-called mindfulness-based interventions, such as mindfulness-based stress reduction and mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which often get presented as universally applicable and as a kind of general remedy for the ills of humanity. And mindfulness is only part of Buddhism, and the specific forms of mindfulness practice involved in the mindfulness-based interventions are arguably not particularly representative of the Buddhist tradition as a whole. And also the range of practices involved in this process of globalization are not at all limited to the Buddhist tradition. Research on these practices, in fact, did not begin with the current wave of interest in Buddhist meditation techniques. And this is part of the reason why my title refers not only to mindfulness, but to life cultivation, a term most familiar in the context of Chinese techniques, probably, and also to mind-body practices in general. Now, mind-body practices is another rather imprecise term, but it does signal one key element of most of these developments, which is that they work in various ways across the mind-body distinction, and they tend to have quite a strong somatic and bodily component. So I said some of you were at the paper I gave yesterday to the New Academy of Contemplative Sciences program at the University of Ottawa. That was concerned with one specific set of issues relating to Tibetan ideas about the so-called subtle body and the ways in which they provide a model of both of what we could call ideal health and also of what we could call mental illness and how to deal with it and how that might interface with certain ideas in Western science. Today's lecture takes a somewhat wider perspective, and it begins more with the specific issue of the mindfulness-based interventions. Now, as many of you will know, the interest in mindfulness as a therapeutic modality within Western medicine got going at the end of the 1970s, 1979 pretty much, with John Kabat-Zinn's introduction of mindfulness-based stress reduction, or of the mindfulness-based stress reduction program. It was originally called something slightly different at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center. And as I've said and written elsewhere, MBSR and related modalities, and if you're into this area, you find the acronyms come rather thick and fast, so you have to get MBSR, MBCT, and lots of others. MBSR and the rest of the alphabet soup are already quite a long way distant from anything that might be labelled as mindfulness in pre-modern Buddhist contexts. The core techniques of MBSR derive from quite recent developments in Buddhist practice, and they are drawn for the most part from traditions of lay Buddhist meditation developed in the Theravada Buddhist countries of Burma and Thailand in the early to mid-20th century. The specific techniques on which MBSR drew, particularly the Vipassana practices associated with Ubakin, S.N. Goenka, Ajahn Chah and others, had already been taught widely in Western Buddhist contexts in North America and elsewhere from the 1960s and 70s onward. But these Southeast Asian and North American approaches already represented what can be called a Buddhist modernism, or modernist Buddhism, and people have used both of those formulations, particularly in their presentation of Buddhism as a philosophy or scientific teaching rather than a religion. And that's something that has a whole history that I won't talk about here, but some of you will know about. Kabat-Zinn and other early teachers were, so it gives you a kind of prospectus of the development, and the only real point about that is it's a bit of a way from that end to this end. Kabat-Zinn and other early teachers were aware of and influenced by other forms of Buddhism, particularly varieties of Tan or Zen Buddhist meditation. But these two had undergone substantial rethinking in modern terms, both in their native context of Japan and in the West. And the central emphasis in MBSR and related techniques on the cultivation of a non-judgmental awareness of what's going on in the present moment, and that in various forms is a key phrase of MBSR and of most of the mindfulness-based interventions that derive from it. Non-judgmental awareness of the present moment reflects, and this reflects both the techniques of Vipassana as taught in these lay Southeast Asian movements and their Western adaptations, and the modernist interpretations of Zen developed by D.T. Suzuki and others in the first half of the 20th century. So there's a whole history there. And this modernist Buddhist background provided the basis for a further modernization and secularization of Buddhism in the form of MBSR itself and the various associated and derivative techniques such as mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, MBCT, developed in the UK by Mark Williams and others. And here I'm using the term secularization as another slightly vague term or differently used term, but to refer to the removal of explicitly religious, spiritual and ethical content and the presentation of these practices, which is very much part of how they were initially presented, as scientific, as explainable in materialist terms, as not involving any kind of religious commitment. Now, admittedly, an ambivalence, makes the point I've just said there, an ambivalence persists regarding how far MBSR and MBCT should, in some sense, be still seen as Buddhist. John Kabat-Zinn himself is a committed Buddhist practitioner, as were many of the people who were involved in introducing these interventions, though by no means all. Kabat-Zinn's writings tend to play it both ways. So he presents mindfulness as not being Buddhism, as not being restricted to Buddhism, but also in some sense representing the essence of Buddhism, the one significant core message of the tradition. So in a sense, if you do mindfulness, you've got the core of Buddhism, although Buddhism is not the same as mindfulness. And this is just a couple of quotes, a fairly quote from 2003 from Kabat-Zinn, which gives you a bit of an idea of how this works. Buddhism is neither a belief, an ideology, nor a philosophy. Rather, it is a coherent phenomenological description of the nature of mind, emotion, and suffering, and its potential release, based on, well, you can read the rest of it. Mindfulness, being about attention, is also of necessity universal. There's nothing particularly Buddhist about it. This is an ideological position about what he's doing at one level, but it's not a question of saying that it's right or wrong, though it's clearly a different perspective from that which you would get from people working in Buddhist studies in many ways. This year, 2017, he was saying slightly different things. And here he's in a way much more explicit about at any rate, the Dharmic motivation, if not the Buddhist motivation behind what he's doing. MBSR, he says, was meant to be a potentially skillful and potent glide path, an interesting expression, into the heart and essence of Dharma wisdom. A first exposure at least, and a direct first person one at that, based entirely on practice and empirical investigation of one's direct experience. But it was not, nor was it ever meant to be, a vehicle for teaching Buddhism per se, disguised, stealth, or of any other variety. And you can see he's actually partly responding, I think, to people who are saying that it was just that. I'm not particularly criticising Kabat-Zinn's motivations or sort of bona fides here. I think if you read some of the literature about MBSR, you appreciate that to actually get this stuff into the University of Massachusetts Medical School in 1979 was not an easy task. And the secularisation, the stress on the scientific side of it, was very much a tactical move that needed to take place. And also that he was doing it, and Kabat-Zinn is somebody with quite a sort of socially activist background in his own life, he was very much doing it as something which he thought would contribute to the betterment of humanity, if you like. So no problems there. But it does create a certain tangle about just what it is that MBSR is. And certainly the originators of these techniques presented them in ways that enabled them to be seen by both therapists and patients as non-religious, and indeed to be accessible because of this non-religious character to those who might reject an explicitly Buddhist approach. And while mindfulness is an attractive label, I mean, being mindful sounds like a good thing to be, certainly it's a positive word in English, its meaning in these contemporary contexts is arguably significantly different from the various meanings of the Buddhist terms, sati in Pali, smriti in Sanskrit, jhampa in Tibetan, and so on, which it purports to translate. The word mindfulness, as deployed by the originators of the main mindfulness-based therapies, has undoubtedly exerted a certain seductive and perhaps misleading power. But mindfulness, as one way of phrasing the ultimate goal of the teachings, is one thing, while mindfulness as a label for a specific set of techniques, such as MBSR and MBCT, is another. It's very easy for the two to become conflated. The explicit rejection of religion in the initial mindfulness-based interventions has led to some commentators raising the question of whether these approaches really represent an authentic version of the Buddhist teachings, and that's perhaps not very surprising. Now, this is a valid question, but the business of origins can be a distraction from the perhaps more significant questions of what our present culture and society is doing with these practices, what we're using them for, what else we might be doing with them. And so I won't actually say much about it today. I've talked elsewhere, and other people such as Ron Purser have talked at considerably greater lengths about how mindfulness-based practices have fitted rather naturally into neoliberal economics, both as performance enhancement techniques for the elite and as a cheap fix for social problems lower down the system. So your working conditions may be totally toxic. You may be crammed into this nasty little office where you can't, the air is unbreathable and whatever. But it's all right. You can do a mindfulness class and learn how to deal with it, and then you'll be fine. You know, and that may sound like a harsh comment, and in some ways it is, because just about all the people I meet who are involved in mindfulness teaching are pretty serious and dedicated about what they're doing. Purser's attack on what he called Mac mindfulness has created more than a little negative reaction. But then Purser, like many of the critics, is himself coming from a Buddhist perspective in many ways. And these critics aren't so much opposed to mindfulness as motivated by frustration of what our society is doing with a practice which could be the founder under tradition, the Buddhist tradition, which they feel could be the foundation for genuine and much needed change at an ethical and social level in our society. So there are some quite serious issues here, but again, I'm not going to deal with them in this paper. I've talked about them elsewhere, except to say a little near the end about how we might develop a more positive vision of these practices in contemporary society. Now, all this aside, I think we can accept that the introduction of the mindfulness-based therapies has by and large been a good thing, though it's rather difficult to establish in objective, scientific, evidence-based terms that it really has. There are certainly arguments about whether the techniques are as effective as is sometimes claimed, both in terms of the standard and quite restrictive procedures of evidence-based medicine and in more general terms. As far as official recognition is concerned, the high point actually came probably in 2009, when the UK's National Institute for Clinical Excellence brought out new guidelines on depression, which recommended MBCT, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which was developed in Oxford and Toronto, for people who are currently well but have experienced three or more episodes of depression, so quite closely defined group of people. But they were saying this is the best treatment, this is the recommended treatment for that group of people, rather than the psychotropic drugs, which was the established treatment until that point. However, while the mindfulness-based techniques are certainly being taught and presumably practiced on quite a large scale, there have been few other major breakthroughs of this kind, and it's less than clear how good mindfulness actually is as a therapeutic technique. A series of systematic reviews and meta-analyses have so far, which is how evidence-based medicine works, as many of you will know, have so far been unable to demonstrate that mindfulness-based therapies are any better than other available therapies in most areas. Some of the problem here is methodological rather than substantive. Despite the large number of studies, and by now this is well into 10,000 plus, I think, there are not very many high-quality studies of the right kind on the mindfulness-based therapies that you can use to evaluate their usefulness. Willoughby Britton, who's herself a significant researcher in this field, comments on the most recent major systematic review, which was the U.S. Association for Health and Research Quality's 2014 report. This review, and pretty much everyone before it, has found that meditation isn't any better than any other kind of therapy. But she goes on to say, the important thing to understand about the report is that they were looking for active control groups. In other words, they were looking for a study where the mindfulness component was parallel to another program that was an active control group rather than weightlifting or some other technique. And they found that only 47 out of over 18,000 studies had them, 47 out of 18,000, which is pretty telling. It suggests that there are fewer than 50 high-quality studies on meditation. That's probably changed a bit because by now active control groups are the flavour of the year in these studies. And the one study I've had a bit to do with certainly has took it for granted from the beginning we were going to have one. But last month, though, Willoughby Britton, along with a series of other leading names in the mindfulness research business, published a quite remarkable paper under the heading Mind the Hype, a critical evaluation and prescriptive agenda for research on mindfulness and meditation. That's the reference, which has got a bit back to front, but it's all right, yeah. This was published in October 2017 in Perspectives on Biological Science Online. First, you see we still haven't got the final journal details, but this has already created quite a few ripples. They note in this article that over the past two decades, writings on mindfulness and meditation practices have saturated the public news media and scientific literature. By 2015, there were approximately 1,200 scientific articles a year. Just imagine reading 1,200 scientific articles a year, and that's just mindfulness, right? And about 33,000 newspaper articles. As their title, Mind the Hype, suggests, they argue that many of the claims made for mindfulness have been exaggerated, that it's been blown up into a kind of panacea, a universal cure for the ills of humanity. And they note that contemplative science, in other words, scientific study of contemplative practices, including but not limited to mindfulness meditation, is particularly vulnerable to hype of various sorts, i.e. tendencies to tout exaggerated positive and negative claims. Van Damme and his colleagues, the collective authorship here, demonstrate at some length the lack of clarity in the scholarly literature about just what is even meant by mindfulness, that people are, in fact, measuring quite different kinds of things, and they have there's no real coherent definition of what it is they're talking about. And they say, given current confusion surrounding mindfulness, we urge scientists, practitioners, instructors, and the public news media to move away from relying on the broad umbrella rubric of mindfulness and towards more explicit differentiated denotations of exactly what mental states, processes, and functions are being taught, practiced, and investigated. In other words, there's all sorts of stuff going on out there, and most of the ways in which it's being measured and tested are not worth much at all. And they point to a series of other methodological issues as well. The first is the imprecision of measuring mindfulness in a coherent and consistent way. And they point to the heavy reliance in a lot of these studies on questionnaires and self-report scales. And, I mean, this is obviously this is an established mode of proceeding in many areas of psychology, but exactly what a self-report scale really tells you about what's going on in terms of somebody's attainment of whatever mindfulness may be is often quite hard to evaluate, even if the scales are relatively consistent in their own operation. Misperceptions about the therapeutic efficacy of mindfulness-based interventions. In other words, there's a widespread assumption that there's strong clinical evidence for their efficacy over a wide range of areas. And as I mentioned above, this is not true, at least not at this stage. We really do not have much solid evidence that they're all that effective. The lack of attention to adverse effects of mindfulness and meditation, and this is something that Britton herself was particularly involved in, because for a while she was running a kind of national advisory service for people who had problems with meditation. I mean, not particularly planned, but things just kind of panned out that way. And in fact running a sort of hostel where they could stay as well. But the point here is that these tend to be systematically neglected in studies. Studies tend to focus on the positive and to say very little about adverse effects. But the adverse effects are real and substantial. And in fact, there's a significant literature about the adverse effects of meditation in various forms of meditation going back to the 1960s at least, and you can get it with a practice called Subud that some of you may have come across, that Indonesian-based meditation form that was rather notorious, the number of Subud practitioners who ended up in psychiatric hospitals, and there was early reports on that. And later on, focusing on Hindu practices such as Kundalini yoga in the late 70s and early 80s, as well as was already writing at that time on Buddhist meditation. But like other material predating the current interest in mindfulness, all this stuff tends to have been kind of ignored and is hardly ever referred to. And finally, what they call questionable interpretations of data from contemplative neuroscience concerning the mental processes and brain mechanisms underlying mindfulness. And I'll say a little bit more about that later on, but those of you who are familiar with neuroscience, and there are probably some of you here who are a lot more familiar than I am, you'll appreciate there's a lot of what goes on in, say, interpreting an fMRI scan involves a huge amount of interpretation and prior assumptions. It's not as if you can rush to a strong interpretation of what's going on. Now, what's striking, apart from the detail and cogency of the points made, is really the group of people making them, who represent many of the leading research groups in the USA working on mindfulness and meditation. And again, this isn't a group of people who are opposed to mindfulness and meditation as such. One group which is not included is Richard Davidson's group at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which was closely linked for many years to the Mind and Life Institute and was probably the highest profile group of all. But there's a response by Davidson and one of his colleagues, Cortland Dahl, in the same journal, which came out immediately after. I'm not quite sure of the exact temporal relation, but certainly it appeared along with a further response by the original authors, in which Davidson and Dahl say that they agree with all the key points made. Well, they try to sound a bit more upbeat about the future prospects, but essentially this is pretty much where we are. They also point out, as the Van Damme group does, that many of these problems are not limited to meditation research, and that's undoubtedly true, but it doesn't really help the situation much as far as mindfulness is concerned. Now, we might not want to go quite as far as the Van Damme group in dismissing the case of the beneficial effects of mindfulness. Evidence-based medicine, with its clinical trials, its randomized double-blind protocols, and its meta-analyses, is a major minefield in its own right. Part of the problem is that whatever mindfulness and meditation may be, they don't fit well into this frame, and that's one reason why the active research controls and so on. Neither, though, do a lot of other things that are also probably quite good for us. Evidence-based medicine is really a way of making decisions about resource allocation, if anything. If you're going to put money into healthcare, meaning conventional healthcare that fits into the RCT framework, it will tell you where it's going to have the most effect. It will tell you what approaches are going to have the highest success rates statistically. It can't tell you what is the best treatment for any individual person, only what gives the best statistical results for a biomedically defined disease category. And if the mindfulness-based techniques are no better than the alternatives in terms of in those terms, in other words, you get 35% of the people with major depression who have some improvement with mindfulness and 35% that get it with drugs. This doesn't tell us, for example, whether some people might not benefit greatly from a specific mindfulness-based technique, even though many others don't. It's a statistical process. And there's another point here too, which is that if the mindfulness-based techniques are no better on average than the alternatives in terms of their ability to assist in, say, recurrent major depressive disorder, they may at least be less harmful in other ways. The mindfulness-based techniques have helped to legitimate a substantial reduction in the massive default prescribing of psychoactive drugs for psychiatric illness. And they've probably enabled significant numbers of people who might have become dependent on such drugs to gain some autonomy, agency, and control over their situation. And if so, we should probably welcome these developments at any rate. But as you can see, it's a slightly messy situation here. But the mindfulness-based techniques are of value, I think, in another respect too, which is that they've allowed psychiatry, clinical psychology, and related disciplines to start taking consciousness and its role in human functioning seriously once more and in a new way. And I think in some ways that is perhaps one of the key things here, to look at what mindfulness has achieved at this point in time. It's perhaps to be a little unfair to it. We're looking at a process which has been going for some time, is undoubtedly going to develop in different ways in the future. And what matters not so much isn't, you know, has this particular intervention, is this the solution to all our problems, but that this is opening up something which is moving on in a number of different ways in the future. And this leads me on to a second major issue, which is that the massive research interest provoked by the mindfulness-based interventions and their various non-medical spin-offs, because of course a lot of this is now happening outside psychiatry, has led to an increased interest in other Buddhist-derived interventions and to other forms of Buddhist meditation. So one major focus of attention in recent years has been on practices deriving from meditations on compassion, including the so-called loving-kindness meditations, which have been developed from the Theravadin metta practices. Just a little bit about loving-kindness. LKM, of course, it's got to have its acronym. Growth of interest in loving-kindness and compassion meditations, I think, is in part a reaction to the tendency of the initial mindfulness-based practices to focus very much on the individual. Most of them, when they're not targeted, as many are, at specific mental disorders, are primarily oriented, or at least presented in terms of assisting people in managing the stresses of contemporary life. Now, this may involve becoming able to function more adequately in a social context, but there isn't much direct focus on the social dimension. It's about you, it's not about you and other people, really. And the Theravadin-derived compassion-oriented practices are explicitly social in nature. While they tend to start, like many of their Buddhist prototypes, with compassion for oneself, they gradually proceed to developing compassion and loving-kindness towards friends, families, and people hostile to the wider population, and so on. And so they provide a kind of natural balance to the self-orientation characteristic of mindfulness practices. Arguably, this is part of their role in Theravadin practice, too. So, here you can see that mindfulness has now provided an opening for something quite different to be looked at. And, in fact, some of the, I think, some of the MBCT protocols now include metta and loving compassion meditation as part of what they're doing. People have been looking, quite a lot of people looking seriously at forms of compassion meditation. The project I'm involved in Sydney is actually about compassion meditation. It's in the context of nurses in the local health system. But being involved in that, you discover that there's a lot of this stuff happening in lots of places. In addition to these Theravada-derived practices, and to start with, I think a lot of this comes out of this sort of perspective that Theravada Buddhism is simpler, is more scientific, is or more amenable to Western adoption. But there's also been a growing interest in compassion-based and other socially oriented practices from other Buddhist traditions, particularly the Tibetan tradition of Lojong, or mind training, which places a lot of emphasis on the development of the compassionate motivation, bodhicitta in Sanskrit, which in Tibetan and Mahayana Buddhism is seen as central to the Buddhist path. So you get a whole series of Lojong-based practices, such as, just an example, is cognitively based compassion training, which was developed at Emory University in 2004 with the participation of the Tibetan teacher Geshe Lobsang Tenzin Nege. For those of you who are familiar with Tibetan Lojong, the steps here are very much parallel to steps in traditional Tibetan Lojong texts, although they're kind of secularized in various ways. Compassion cultivation training develops at Stanford University in conjunction with another Tibetan teacher, Geshe Thupten Jinpa, who some of you will know since he's based in Montreal and has a connection with the McGill Department of Religious Studies, as well as being the main translator for the Mind and Life Institute dialogues, which I mentioned earlier. And there have been a variety of other spin-offs from Tibetan practices, including cultivating emotional balance program, which grew out of another Mind and Life dialogue, focusing on the control of the so-called destructive emotions. We saw the book about destructive emotions a little while ago, and I also talked a little bit about the destructive emotions or root kleshas. These are desire, hatred, ignorance, and they're seen as fundamental to the Buddhist analysis of what goes on in human life, essentially. Shamatha practice developed by Alan Wallace on Tibetan foundations, and the subject of one of the biggest of these evaluations, the Templeton Foundation-funded Shamatha project, and so on. So quite a lot of different things now coming up and both being used and being investigated and researched. And we're also beginning to see something that's taken quite a while, some serious studies of meditative practices in Tibetan Tantric Buddhism proper, including deity yoga, tummo or psychic heat practice, cultivation of non-dual awareness, and some of these things that might seem a bit more esoteric but are quite central within the Tibetan tradition at any rate. There's been interest in Nikan, a psychotherapeutic practice derived from Japanese Buddhism, and a variety of other East Asian practices. And there's signs, too, of a renewed interest in practices from Hindu and Taoist sources and other East Asian contexts. The whole martial arts area is one that I think has some relevance here, for example, as well as in practices originating from Christian, Jewish, and Islamic traditions. And as I've already noted, there's already a body of research on quite a bit of this stuff from the 60s and 70s, including work on transcendental meditation, kundalini yoga, tai chi, qigong, etc. In what one could call pre-mindfulness days, most of this was not taken very seriously by the scientific establishment. So the Maharishi University was doing a lot of stuff on TM, but nobody else was really looking at it, as far as I could see. But the high profile of research on mindfulness and Buddhist meditation in recent years has, I think, helped to create a climate in which this wider spectrum of contemplative and mind-body practices can be given more of the attention it arguably deserves. And certainly, I think part of what we need to do is, if this whole movement makes any sense, is to look at the whole range of techniques that are available and start understanding what specific techniques are useful for, what they can do, rather than focusing on one as the ultimate. Now, I don't want to convey the idea that all this is straightforward and positive. In many ways, the field is becoming increasingly complex and difficult to construe. And one central issue which is increasingly raised by many of the newer practices is the moral and spiritual dimension. It's one thing to secularize Goenka-style vipassana, which is the major source for mindfulness-based stress reduction. That had already gone through quite a lot of prior modernization and secularization by the time it became established within the West. Although even there it's arguable that an important dimension has been omitted. It's another matter, I think, to do the same thing with Tibetan Lojong, let alone with Tibetan deity yoga, which are much more firmly embedded in a structure of thought and ideas that's essentially ethical and religious. Do these practices really make sense without karma, without rebirth, without the ultimate goal of Buddhahood? But I don't think the question of where religion fits in can be indefinitely swept under the carpet. It's actually intrinsic to the whole field of contemplative studies. And if we're now going to have to deal with it explicitly, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. We are, after all, now living, all of us, in a world where the dominance of a certain kind of secular rationality can no longer be taken for granted. We only have to look at the position of Islam in the modern world, at the massive Hindu revival that's being supported by the current Indian government. For that matter, even the modes of thought of contemporary China, which may claim scientific rationality, but it's a very different kind of orientation from what we have here. And I think we need at the very least to become religiously literate if we're to negotiate this new, much more plural environment. We need to understand what the religious and spiritual dimension of these practices means. So, somewhat parallel to all this, as I said at the beginning, has been the growth of neuroscientific research on various Buddhist meditation practices. And part of the point about the Van Damme article was that it was also quite critical about much of this. And I mentioned at this reference the naive use of data from contemplative neuroscience, which purported to represent mental processes and brain mechanisms underlying mindfulness. Well, if mindfulness has become an area where we need to mind the hype, probably even the same is true even more strongly of neuroscience. And we're all used to these sorts of pictures by now with little bits of the brain lighted up and all sorts of deductions claimed from them. It's actually got to the point where people do research on neurohype and neuroenchantment, and just for amusement, perhaps I pass on some details of a recent McGill study in which the researchers introduced participants to a crudely built mock brain scanner, explaining that the machine would measure neural activity, analyse the data, and then infer the content of complex thoughts. Using a classic magic trick, we crafted an illusion whereby the imaging technology seemed to decipher the internal thoughts of participants, and we found that most students, even undergraduates with advanced standing in neuroscience and psychology, who'd been taught that this stuff was all nonsense, I'm taught the shortcomings of neuroimaging, deemed such unlikely technology highly plausible. Our findings highlight the influence neurohype wields over critical thinking. Well, okay, we have been warned, but I think much of the scientific community is beginning to realise that the results of MRI scanning, while certainly interesting, don't provide the levels of insight into the mechanisms of consciousness that some of the early hype suggested. This isn't to suggest that they're not worth doing. There's certainly been perhaps a level of commitment of resources to this stuff which is a bit overblown. But at this stage, it seems to be more interesting actually to see what's going on outside the brain in the autonomic nervous system than inside it. And that's what I'm going to turn to focus on a bit now. I discussed this a little in yesterday's paper, since the central issue there was the Tibetan understanding of mental disorders in terms of imbalances in the flow of lung, of prana, or wind in the subtle body. And I pointed out that there seemed to be significant similarities and potential connections between Tibetan ideas of the flow of lung in the subtle body and Western models of the autonomic nervous system. Now, the thing about the autonomic nervous system as distinct from the brain, is that since it's so closely connected to bodily processes, you can actually see what's going on with much more clarity, and things are going on. In fact, the first major neuroscientific paradigm for the understanding of meditation, which goes back to this cheery gentleman, Herbert Benson at Harvard, a cardiologist who did early research on transcendental meditation and developed the idea of the relaxation response. This is a number one national bestseller, sold millions of copies, you know, etc. Back in the 70s. The idea here was to see meditation as a cultural technique for cultivating a particular response in the autonomic nervous system. And the idea here was the normal human and animal response to stress is stimulation of the sympathetic nervous system, the so-called fight or flight response, involving the production of cortisol and adrenaline. But this isn't a terribly good thing for you if you're doing it all the time and you're constantly in this sort of fight or flight mode, whatever. But meditation leads to an alternative response, according to Benson, the stimulation of the parasympathetic nervous system, and leading to relaxation and calming. So instead of being caught up in the so-called ergotropic fight-or-flight response, arousal, adrenaline, the rest of it, you're in the nice, calm, relaxing parasympathetic nervous system. Excitation. Okay. And this is a good thing because too much stimulation of the sympathetic nervous system is not very good for you. Now, Benson, who was initially working with, as I said, with transcendental meditation, not Buddhist meditation, thought that virtually all cultures had mechanisms of this kind, and he developed the relaxation response into a kind of universal explanation for all sorts of religious practices. There's also a whole argument one can fit in here about stress. Which is, as some of you will know, is a Canadian development. It was developed by a Hungarian endocrinologist, Hans Zelli, in Montreal in the 1930s and 40s. I mean, stress in our current modern understanding, the one that we're all really familiar with, stress is something that, you know, we're struggling with all the times in our daily lives and so on. But I'll leave both of these aside for the moment, fascinating though they really are. But there is, I think, an obvious question here about how this model relates to traditional understandings of meditation and what it's for. And I think that, you know, at this point in time, if you talk to ask most people in the lay population who've heard about meditation, what is it for? They'll give you some kind of response, which is something to do with relaxation and calming and whatever. But equally, that's pretty obviously not what Buddhist meditation claims to be for. It's not about relaxation. It's about liberation from samsara, from the everyday world of our experience, and in the Mahayana tradition, the attainment of Buddhahood. This is something which is to do with a radical transformation of who you are and how you relate to the universe. And it's not a particularly gentle or relaxing process necessarily. And other Asian religious traditions have similar goals. More generally, how does one relate the traditional, often quite complex and sophisticated understandings of the purposes and mechanisms of Buddhist and other forms of Asian meditation practice, in which consciousness plays a central role, to the kind of neurological and basically somewhat materialist model advanced by Benson? Now, what's happened in recent years has been a kind of two-way movement. Oh, it's just the kind of picture you get in your average introductory anatomy textbook or whatever about the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems, which are seen as neatly separate from each other, which is another issue here. But anyway, what has happened in recent years, and I've just put a few references up for those of you who might be interested, has been a kind of twofold movement, mostly arising from cooperative work between scholars of Buddhism working primarily on texts and practices and neuroscientists working experimentally with Buddhist meditators. And one major development from the Buddhist scholars, and this is in the first two articles, really, the two ones with Lutz, Dan Davidson, and Helene Stubter in the second case, too. One major development, what they did was to take the well-known distinction between shamatha and vipassana calm and insight, or variously rendered practices in Buddhism, and see what this looked like in neuroscientific terms, where they get translated as focused attention and open monitoring, or FA and OM, but it's got to have the acronyms. The results here were rather disappointing, in part because some of the same methodological issues we were considering earlier, and also because one of these is that shamatha and vipassana, or FA and OM, actually understood quite differently in different Buddhist traditions anyway. It isn't as if one's dealing with a single systematic distinction which can be easily operationalised. And the question of how far meditating subjects were in fact achieving something that corresponded to states of shamatha and vipassana, and whether these were the same things, is again perhaps arguable. But this at least started a movement towards looking at how Buddhists and other Asian traditions defined meditation and practices and understood what they thought they were doing, as distinct from this purely Western take. Another question that started to be taken more seriously was that of attention and alertness. Now, if Buddhist meditation is primarily aimed at awakening, and the, as many of you will know, the Sanskrit root behind the word Buddha, Bodhi and so on, is means awakening, how can one reconcile this with the emphasis on relaxation and the activation of the parasympathetic nervous system and this kind of, you know, chill out, cool down, you know? So you get this paper from 2014. Well, you already get a bit of this actually in the first of those papers, the one in the Cambridge Handbook of Consciousness, but Willoughby Britton and Gerard Lindell and all in 2014 published this article, Awakening is Not a Metaphor. This is really what you're trying to do in the practice. And so, is all this relaxation stuff actually making you more awake? And if so, how does that work? And what they actually do is to argue that there's a specific type of alertness, this tonic alertness, it's technically called, which is associated with the activation of the parasympathetic nervous system, and which is quite different from the kind of alertness that's associated with the sympathetic nervous system activation. And while learning to do this, learning to operate with the parasympathetic system, might initially lead to drowsiness and lack of attention, in time, the meditator learns to maintain tonic alertness, to maintain a level of clarity without effort. This really is a training in alertness. It's just a different one from what we were thinking of. Now, around the same time, the fourth and fifth studies on the list here, which involved Maria Kozhevnikov and Ido Amihai was basically her research assistant in the study. Kozhevnikov is a neuroscientist based in Singapore and Harvard, who'd previously done research on Tibetan deity yoga and Tummo psychic heat practices. And she did a four-way study of two forms of Theravadin meditation and two forms of Tibetan meditation. And the idea was to choose an FA and OM practice, a focused attention and open monitoring practice in each case. But what turned out was that the really strong differences between the Tibetan practices, which involved high levels of arousal of the sympathetic nervous system, and the two Theravadin practices, which involved activation of the parasympathetic nervous system, which puts a big question next to this whole FAOM thing altogether, but then it was beginning to look pretty questionable. And what this, but then where the argument went from this was that people started thinking, well, we're looking at two different kinds of alertness or awakening in the two cases, the tonic alertness in the Theravadin cases, and phasic alertness is the term in the other one, Tibetan cases. In fact, this isn't really, I think, just a Tibetan Theravadin distinction. You can find practices in both on both sides that involve both sides of alertness, though Theravadin practice probably tends more to the calm and relaxed states, and many Tibetan tantric practices seem to involve quite high levels of arousal. But the next step then became to ask whether the practices in both cases, Theravadin and Tibetan, were actually aiming at something which was neither simple activation on one side or the other, but some kind of more complex and developed state which involved a different way of operating with the nervous system as a whole. And actually, Jeffrey Lidker commenting on Kashevnikov in a paper last year, makes this point, but it had been made by a couple of other people in different ways earlier on. And as I suggested in yesterday's paper, for those of you who are there, it fits rather neatly with the idea of the two outer channels and the central channel of the tantric subtle body. Do I have a picture of the tantric subtle body here? No, you don't, sorry. Which correspond in some ways to the PNS and SNS, the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous systems, both in form and function. Now, I don't want to take that argument further here because, although, as I said in my seminar yesterday, brings us to a rather interesting point that there seems to be a convergence between scientific and Buddhist understandings, although there are also important ways in which the languages and conceptual assumptions are different, and how we move on from there I think is quite an interesting issue. But there are other developments on the neuroscientific side that would give some more strength to this picture of meditation, emotion, psychic health and so on as being all part of what is now looking like a general model. One is the renewed growth of interest in mapping both emotional states and psychiatric disorders onto patterns of functioning or malfunctioning of the central nervous system. And this happened, for example, in areas like autism spectrum problems, which are now increasingly seen as connected with problems of the autonomic nervous system, but it's happening in a variety of other areas too. And this moves us away from this rather crude and mechanical dichotomy between the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous systems towards a more nuanced sense of different patternings of activity within the central nervous system as a whole. And I think this could provide a very interesting integrated model of mental illness, mental health, and neurodiversity that's consonant in many ways with Buddhist and Asian thought. Another interesting development here is the growing interest in neuroscience in something called predictive processing, which some of you may know something about, in which patterns of neural activity are seen as filtering and shaping our perceptions, both externally and internally. So we don't just perceive things, that the perception is filtered through neural patterns of various kinds, which is, I mean, in a way, it's not a kind of an amazing insight intuitively, but it's one that it's taken quite a while to start experimentally investigating, and this has been going for about 4 or 5 years now, and on a reasonably large scale, and it's becoming quite a well-established and interesting model, which I think helps to fit together all these various bits and pieces. And I don't want to make it all sound too neat, but sort of see what I mean. Part of what's going on here, and it's also a model which has quite striking similarities to Buddhist ideas about perception, which is also interesting. Part of what's going on here, I think, ironically, in view of the complexity and sophistication of Western science, is it's actually taken Western science quite a while to generate models of neural activity that are complex enough to be able to start looking for meaningful correspondences between Asian and Western conceptions. And I think this is one of the points where this whole process becomes more of a dialogue and less of a kind of raiding of Asia for interesting bits and pieces, if you like. It's I think we are at a quite different stage now, and it's a very interesting one. Because it seems that we're actually beginning at last to get to the point where this is happening, where there's a kind of mutual interchange that's leading to an increase in subtlety and understanding on the Western scientific side too. If that's so, I think we're likely to see some very interesting developments in contemplative science over the next 2 or 3 decades. That's just the 2 points about emotional and states and psychiatric disorders being linked to the functioning of the central nervous system. Polyvagal theory, which I have to admit I only heard about 3 or 4 days ago, so also seems to fit rather nicely into this pattern, but who knows. And as you probably gather, I'm still finding my way around this stuff. I'm not a neuroscientist, it's probably pretty obvious. My basic training's in anthropology, and I did a bit of physics before that. I've moved into Buddhist studies and so on, but I'm having lots of fun anyway, and it's interesting stuff. But finally, a few conclusions. I've got about another 2 or 3 minutes. I think there is a need, in conclusion, to confront the whole question of the religious and transpersonal dimensions within meditation and related techniques. And I've mentioned this a few times as I've gone along. As I pointed out in yesterday's paper, we may well have a convergence between neuroscience and Buddhist thought, but we are a long way from an identity between the two. Other Asian traditions that I've mentioned also work with understandings of the world that go beyond the materialist reduction of consciousness to an epiphenomenon of neural and physiological processes within individual bodies, both in terms of more social and field-oriented dimension and in terms of assumptions about subtle levels of consciousness or whatever. Buddhism itself does not arise out of a materialist perspective, and several of its core assumptions, for example regarding consciousness and its continuity between lives, are very difficult to reconcile with any such perspective. Now, there are a couple of ways in which one can respond to this conflict of worldviews, which of course doesn't only occur on the boundary between Buddhism and science, but on any number of similar boundaries between pre-modern and contemporary understandings of the universe. What do you do with languages of deities and spirits and so on? Do you just junk them, or do you attempt to find some kind of sense in them? One way you can go is to insist on maintaining the materialist perspective at all costs and to erect a kind of hermetic cordon sanitaire between scientific and other models of the universe. The other is to allow for a mutual interaction and cross-fertilization between scientific and non-scientific models, which might generate new understandings that draw from both sources. And that, I think, is something that we're beginning to see signs of in this particular dialogue, and which is part of what I find so exciting about it. Certainly as somebody who's been working for years on modes of healing in Tibetan and other societies that seem to be efficacious in ways that fit very poorly into the canons of evidence-based medicine, although being real enough for those who practice them, I find this is a very positive development and one that I hope might lead us to be able to both to take some of these modes of healing much more seriously and to learn to integrate how they work much more effectively into our own society. And in support of this option, it's worth considering the nature of Western science a little more closely. Western science is not, in fact, a unitary, mutually consistent body of ideas that's effectively and finally established the validity of the materialist model. It's really much more a collection of separate fields and projects, often based on mutually contradictory assumptions. Engineers and chemists and theoretical physicists are not necessarily talking about the same things at all, really. Science does not deal in facts, despite the tendency of popular magazines and other mass media to present it as if it does, but in theories and conceptual frameworks that always retain a fundamentally hypothetical character. And so any convention that science has finally and irrevocably established the truth of a thoroughgoing and exclusive materialism is bound to go far beyond the available evidence. In addition, many areas of science are deeply invested by large-scale financial interests, and that's probably not news to anybody here. Evidence-based medicine and its relationship with the pharmaceutical industry is a classical example. And this, of course, has led to without the point where most scientific papers, certainly in the medical field, come with demands for disclosure of relevant financial and other interests. And the reason for this is, of course, because of the assumption that those financial interests might affect the findings, might affect what is which of your results get reported and which of them, and how the research is framed in the first place, and all sorts of other levels. I think it's quite difficult to appreciate the massive scale on which these processes can affect and distort scientific results. It's not simply a question of the results of individual studies, but the wider issue of the procedures by which studies are carried out, the fields which receive funding, the scholars who are endorsed, rewarded, and employed, the areas of knowledge which are seen as legitimate. And there's a huge series of areas here that need to be taken increasingly seriously, I think. And even when we can see this in relation to fields of which we have some direct knowledge, so I mean, you may be a chemist and you know what goes on in chemistry, you don't necessarily have a sense of how it works in other fields. So I think there's substantial evidence for a more complex relationship between consciousness and material reality than the default versions accepted by workers in fields such as neuroscience and biomedicine. The complex interrelationship between individual, society, culture and environment already points in this direction, and it's particularly evident in areas such as healing, which often seems, certainly in the anthropological literature, to be very much a social process. But I think the role of society, of culture, of meaning, consciousness in healing is increasingly something that's coming into focus, in part as we're re-evaluating ideas like the placebo effect and so on in terms of processes of meaning in healing. Then there are the bodies of experimental evidence that are routinely ignored and marginalised, such as those which support the continuity of consciousness outside a material basis. Some of you may know the volume edited by Edward Kelly and others called Irreducible Mind, which is a nice summary of a lot of this stuff, and there's been other writing in this area recently. And some of the things which it hasn't been kind of respectable to say for quite a long time now seem to be becoming rather more sayable, which I think is an interesting development too. So all this suggests that a degree of modesty might be appropriate in relation to claims that Western science is the fount of all valid knowledge and that it has established the truth of a fully materialist account of the universe. Whether we like it or not, we're all living in an increasingly pluralist world, as I said earlier on, in which the dominance of specifically Western understandings cannot be guaranteed. All of us, wherever we might be positioned in relation to particular knowledge claims about religion or science, might be better advised to accept the limited nature of our partial understandings of the universe. It's getting a bit preachy, isn't it?
We're happy to be preached.
If then we find... I'm not sure I'm happy to preach. If then we find ourselves employing therapeutic techniques whose underlying postulates conflict with the default assumptions of Western science. I got entangled in this through these Tibetan long life practices, which are wonderful things, but I'm not going to talk about them today. I've written about them. If anybody's interested, you can find some of this. It may be that rather than struggling to elide and remove the offending aspects, trying to kind of secularize Tibetan long life practice, which I think is probably a pretty hopeless undertaking, we might be better off to seek to live with them and see where that takes us. To stay with the open question and not to seek for resolution or an answer, as the late Francisco Varela, who was one of the leading early people in the Mind and Life Institute dialogues, put it in an interview not long before his death. And he was talking about the question of continuity of consciousness between minds. Perhaps I can sort of lay the rest of my cards on the table to conclude by saying that I feel that for all its massive scale, the mindfulness movement, along with the other developments I've been discussing here, needs to be seen in that even wider context of the ongoing transformation of Western and indeed global consciousness as humanity comes to terms with a rapidly changing world, changing both in terms of human populations and in terms of the planet. Oh, there's actually another two pages here, sorry. Planet on which we live. Is that okay? I don't want to overstay my welcome. The connections between human beings are changing very rapidly in nature and intensity. New technologies are continually changing our sense of who we are and how we relate to each other. And obviously, things like the new social media, the cell phones and smartphones and so on, and lots of others. The limits placed upon us by the planetary ecology are also beginning to impact on us in ways that we can no longer ignore and push aside. Populations that have previously been relatively insulated from each other by massive obstacles of distance and difficulty of travel are now impacting directly upon each other as tens of millions of people seek to move from impoverished and politically unstable areas of the world to those where conditions are more tolerable. This isn't news to anybody, obviously. Reactive nationalisms seek to keep these populations out, causing human disasters on an increasing scale. As of the tens of thousands of people dying while attempting to cross the Mediterranean from Africa to Europe, to get out of Myanmar into Bangladesh or Thailand, to travel from Southeast Asia to Australia. All this is likely to get far worse before it improves. And this implies that we're going to have to learn to live together in ways very different from those that served us in the past. We need to develop modes of knowledge that can aid and facilitate these new learnings. And I think that context is for me helpful in looking at the whole question of the mindfulness movement and what it has to teach us. If we regard mindfulness techniques merely as a way of solving our individual problems, we're likely to find that the collective problems which we're ignoring will rapidly undercut our individual solutions. But if we see the mindfulness techniques more as an opportunity to recognize the presence and significance of collective and social processes within the sphere of consciousness and to explore their relationship to the world of material reality, we may find ourselves better equipped to create the new forms of knowledge and the new ways of working that might give the human population of this planet a chance of surviving the next 50 or 100 years. I think I'll stop there.